All right, we will talk some Last Jedi Star Wars craps.
Star Wars craps.
Star Wars craps. I rolled a 7.
Only at Caesar's Palace. You roll a 7 in craps?
Oh, yeah. That's what you want to do, right?
That could be good. Well, no, it depends. What'd you roll on your second roll is what's important in craps.
A 3 and a 4.
Well, then you lose. You don't know how to play craps.
I don't know how to play craps. Okay. That's the one I stay away from. I also don't really, really totally understand roulette, but every time I sit down, I walk away with 10 times the amount of money I started with.
All I know is if you play Baccarat, you have to talk like this the whole time.
I'm pretty sure that's not how that goes.
That's exactly how it goes, and you don't have the slightest idea about it.
The Major Spoilers podcast covers news, reviews, and of course, spoilers, and goes into details about the topics discussed. So if you haven't read, listened, or watched the items we talk about, you might want to come back later.
I'm Matthew.
I'm Ashley.
I'm Rodrigo.
And I'm Steven, and you are listening to the Major Spoilers podcast, the podcast for pop culture and comic fans.
In this issue, Call of Cthulhu, Americarate, a new start for an old doctor. Plus, we wander the Elseworlds to wonder what happens for want of the nail. Plus, a full array of pop culture news, thoughtful discussion, and the kick butt poll of the week. If you imagine a world where one essential component is missing, the one thing that would make all the difference in the world, can you imagine a world without the Major Spoilers podcast? No, you can't. You don't have to. Here it is.
Welcome to issue 725, 725 episodes of the Major Spoilers podcast. We are getting so close to passing up the Batman and the Supermans and the Action Comics in their numberings.
Yeah, they're in the 900s.
So we'll hit the 900s. We'll hit the 900s very soon. By the end of the year, we will be at 775. And so, yeah, we'll catch up to them soon enough.
In the next 6 years.
Because you know that there will be an event that will cause them to start the renumbering over at zero. And then we'll have at least 5 years of that. And then we'll get up into the thousands. Restart.
Yeah, but doesn't they'll decide to renumber not count, though? I mean, it's not like they end at 750, then do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then pick up at 751.
It'll give us a chance. It'll give us a chance to catch up. Trust me.
But we can't. That's not
trust
out.
Me.
But numbers don't.
We will catch up to them sooner than you think.
Remember, kids, Steven is a liberal arts major, so.
We will catch up to them sooner than you think. Trust me. Let us do some news.
Trusted you once and 11 years later.
And look, your life is so much better that you're eating chopsticks with your Cheetos now.
Yes, one thing I said you were right about in 25 years, and you will not let it die.
I think we can go back and find some other times you said I'm right. But let's get us to some news. Star Wars Celebration took place over the weekend, and we also have a new person writing the Wonder Woman comic. Let's spin that wheel of destiny. All right, just flip that coin of destiny and see which side it lands on. Oh, there it lands on Star Wars Celebration. So Star Wars Celebration, big to-do going on over the Easter weekend. It always amazes me when conventions and events happen on major holiday weekends, and yet it doesn't affect attendance at all.
Kamikaze is always on Halloween, and that's when the cosplay gets really out of control.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Stan Lee's Los Angeles Comic Book Convention.
I think they had to rename the day Stan Lee Day for that event.
No, I think Stan Lee Day is the guy who directed The Searchers.
This year, Star Wars Celebration is all about The Last Jedi, or excuse me, Star Wars Episode 8, The Last Jedi.
Don't say the colon out loud.
Yeah. Star Wars colon.
Star Wars colon movie film for theaters.
Yes.
Star Wars insert colon title
here. Star Wars colon insert title here. Did you guys get a chance to take a look at the quote unquote teaser trailer for The Last Jedi?
Yes.
It's a long, loving pan of many things.
What did you think, Ashley?
It has my Star Wars boyfriend in it.
Which one is that? Poe Dameron or BB-8?
No. I can't say expletives in the show, so no. It's got Luke Skywalker in it.
And Luke Skywalker
gets to freaking talk
for the whole
that's
trailer.
All I wanted. I thought the trailer kind of sucked.
To be fair, he did talk in the trailer for the last one too.
I know.
He did talk in the movie.
I do think it's weird that there's this new trend with Star Wars trailers where we have to show someone like like panting, because we had that same thing when we saw Finn pop up and everyone lost their mind that there could possibly be a black stormtrooper. So I think it's weird that in a way to up the stakes, we have to see that like they're so intense that they're almost out of breath. And I really thought that the only thing that was either interesting or revelatory about it was the implication that maybe the Jedi need to go away. And maybe the Sith need to go away. And since gray force wielders have been cropping up in a lot of the new extended universe stuff, if Luke is going to be championing that idea, which is me extrapolating a lot from the trailer, I'm on board for that. But otherwise, it was just like, well, we know you're going to come see this movie. So like, here's Kylo Ren's face, whatever.
Yeah, right. But here's the thing. It's not just cropping up in the trailer. It's also cropping up on the poster, because if you look at the lightsaber that Rey is holding,
poster,
it starts off blue and fades to red up at the tip. Oh, yeah. That's pretty interesting.
I mean, because there's a lot of gray force wielders that are being featured on Rebels, specifically like Bendu, the Force Doctor.
Yeah, the monster
right
guy. Yeah.
Yeah, he's awesome.
Yeah, I really liked him.
Force Doctor?
He's voiced by Tom Baker.
Yeah.
Is he?
Yeah, it's really cool. He's a really kick-ass character that plays a big role in season 3 of the series, but probably we're not seeing him next season. And by the way, season 4 is the last season of Star Wars Rebels, only because
just let Hera and Kanan kiss.
Well, I'm sure that's going to happen. Season 4 now will literally bump up against Rogue One, which will literally lead us into A New Hope. So I'm very interested to see what they do in season 4. Do you think, are we going to see Kanan and the little kid die? What's his name?
Ezra.
Are we going to see them bite the bullet?
I think you have to. And I think you have to confirm the death of Ahsoka, which we've been dancing around forever. Because to have all those characters be alive, even if they're going to like Obi-Wan Kenobi it and live in a desert cave somewhere, it negates everything that we've been taught for decades is special about Luke, and it sort of undermines the entire premise of A New Hope. Now I know it's a kid's show and you can't like brutally slaughter them, but we did see Darth Maul die pretty epically. So
yeah.
I kind of think they have to die, or we have to see them going into the Battle of Scarif, because the ghost is in that battle. You can see it in Rogue One, and just assume that they die in a blaze of glory.
I would imagine that. That's my hope. But I'm going to be kind of sad to see Star Wars Rebels end. For me, Star Wars Rebels, and I know, Ashley, you're someone who sits down and watches it religiously every week when a new episode comes out.
I buy it on Amazon.
I sit down and I watch it in big bursts. So, like, when the new season starts, I will watch, like, the first 3 episodes, and then something will preoccupy me, like the new Stranger Things season or something. And then I will sit down about this time, just like I did with season 3, and just blow through, 12 episodes, 20 episodes, however many that'll be. Next season, I think, is going to be 13 episodes. I will blow through 10 episodes in a row and just be like, oh my God, this is so good. Why are more people not watching this show? It's really that good. And I don't know, Matthew or Rodrigo, if you guys have watched Star Wars Rebels, but there's some deep storytelling, especially when you're getting into the Mandalorians and their role in the Empire.
Oh, it's so good. Sabine is so good.
When you're looking at Admiral Thrawn and his role in the Empire, even they've got, Star Wars season 3. Well, season 2 had Darth Vader in it. Season 3 has Thrawn and Tarkin in it. Yeah. And it's fascinating.
No, I've never really watched any of the cartoon Star Wars. I watched Droids 25 years ago, if that helps, but no.
Rodrigo, what about you? Have you seen Star Wars The Rebels or this Last Jedi trailer you have some thoughts on?
I did see the trailer. The most interesting thing to me was spaceships scraping up against the desert and bringing up some red dust. Mm-hmm. That looked pretty good. Mm-hmm. It also speaks to the rest of the trailer that was the most interesting part to me. I'm interested in seeing where these characters are going. I kind of felt that in the last movie, the older characters took a very prominent spot, and you know, there was kind of like this back and forth, like struggle for screen time. And hopefully with this, they actually grow, let the new kids grow a little bit more. Although it looks like Luke Skywalker is very prominent, so we're probably going to get a similar situation. You know, I'm interested to see where it goes, but I'm not super excited.
They
necessarily
did.
Not any more than any other movie coming out this year.
Right now, Carrie Fisher's brother had said that she was going to appear in episode 9. Kathleen Kennedy said, no, that's not the case. He's mistaken. You're going to see a lot of her in episode 8, but she definitely will not be in episode 9. That was another thing that was made public during the Star Wars celebration. And then also the other thing that I found super fascinating is a slew of new comic properties and animated shorts and all sorts of things are going to be cropping up over the next year or so. As we lead into this film, part of it is Ashley, what is it with the young female heroes? They're getting like a bunch of 2 and 3 minute shorts on YouTube.
Oh, you mean DC Superhero Girls? I'm sorry.
No,
heroines of the Force.
Yes, that's what it is. Yes.
It looks amazing, but it's seriously like they saw that Superhero Girls made like millions of dollars and were like, yeah. Oh, crap.
Disney
but we're Star Wars.
Girls.
Yeah, really.
It's almost like suddenly, oh, we can take this geek culture stuff and girls are interested in it. Oh, okay. It just seems kind of no brainer. But I mean, yes, a lot of dolls, a lot of the action figure stuff, but also this animated series that will then be released later on Disney XD as a full length episode or series or movie. That seems very interesting. And then also they are going to start targeting younger kids with some Star Wars comics coming to IDW Publishing, including some stuff specifically targeted towards what is it?
Why are they not at Marvel? Marvel,
yeah, that is
Star
that
Wars
is
license.
The most interesting part of the story is the IDW side of it,
right? Mm-hmm. So right now Marvel has the movie adaptations. They have the Poe Damerons and the Doctor, what's her name?
Dr. Aphra.
Dr. Aphra. They had the Princess Leia, the Darth Vader series. They had all that stuff. But then Star Wars Adventures pops up over at IDW, and there's another Star Wars property, another Disney property, DuckTales and Tangled, based on the Tangled movie. Those are also getting series over at IDW Publishing. And the minute I read that, I was like, what's going on that this stuff isn't at Marvel? And also, why is this stuff not going back to Dark Horse if they're looking at another publisher? What are your guys' reaction to this, Ashley?
I have weird feel. I don't know is really where I land. I think IDW handles this kind of thing better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I think ultimately it's for the best, although I'm surprised that you wouldn't have gone boom if you're looking, you know.
Yes, that would be the next question.
But it has to be some internal politics or a pre-existing deal. I mean, IDW works with DC,
right,
on some shared property. So maybe there was always a deal in place there. And then again, the question is raised about why didn't one of these things maybe go to Dark Horse that held the Star Wars licensed for so long and so successfully. I just think, yeah. I don't have a great conclusion about it. I just have like a ton of questions.
Matthew, do you have any thoughts on that?
I have a couple of theories.
Okay, first theory.
I think that if they're announcing something that is aimed at younger readers, taking it away from Marvel is a good idea, because Marvel is really good at bald guys in their 40s with hats on. But I can't remember the last time I actually read something at Marvel that I would say is actually truly a younger reader's
Well,
title.
They have the Disney
stuff.
Well, they have their Disney series like the Tiki Room and the Big Thunderbolt Express and I forget what the Haunted Mansion, and those were all kind of kid friendly books.
But were they? I mean, were they?
I think so. Yeah, I read like the first issue.
Were they books that would appeal to kids, or were they books that were what Marvel thought should appeal to kids?
Well, I mean, one could argue that, but when I read the Tiki Room, I was like, oh yeah, this is definitely kid stuff. Big Thunder Mountain had a tween heroine as the central character, and that seemed right up a kid-friendly area. So, you know, to hear that Tangled and DuckTales are both at IDW Publishing, not Boom Studios, and then also Star Wars Adventures is over at IDW makes me, my theory would be, oh, we need to make sure that we spread this around so that we don't get nailed for vertical integration. Stuff. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We don't, synergy.
Yeah. What was your second theory there, Matthew?
My second theory is that IDW came to them with a cheaper bid. That they said, hey, Marvel, what would it cost to do X, Y, and Z? And Marvel said this, and they're like, oh, well, we're going to shop it around. And they shopped it around, and IDW was like, oh, yeah, we'll undercut them. We've also got ROM, you know.
Yeah. Roger, does that seem like something synergistic that Disney Marvel should be doing or not doing?
I mean, they should be doing it because that would be the synergy there, right? Specifically, your House of Mouse ate your House of Ideas for mm-hmm. this reason.
Mm-hmm.
I guess more in the opposite direction to mine it for properties, but here's this perfect shoot to just be able to do it. And I think really what it was is that Marvel doesn't have that side of things together. That, you know, maybe somebody came down and was like, hey, so new Star Wars is coming up. Here are all the projects that you guys need to do. Go for it. And they checked on them again a month later, and they're like, where are these projects in the pipeline? And they were like, Thor? So they're like, okay, you know what? Like, this needs to come out. The Star Wars stuff needs to be in people's hands by the time these and these and these benchmarks roll around. Marvel just isn't doing it, or is not going to do it fast enough, or it's mm-hmm. not going to do it well enough in the time allotted. I don't think it's about cost. I think it's about, like, basically manpower, because Marvel, you know, I think is actually not that big of a company as far as how many people are employed at Marvel, not the comic side of Marvel. Mm-hmm. So all of this sourcing of artists and writers and all this stuff for these projects that are coming from on high might be something that Marvel just hasn't been handling well.
Well, and, you know, to support your theory, the Force Awakens movie adaptation is finishing up now.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great example, right? It's like, maybe that's what they did. Maybe for The Force Awakens, they were like, okay, Marvel, here's all the projects that you need to roll out. And Marvel is still working on them. So next time around, they're like, let's go with the adaptation guys for this and let weird nerds on a podcast speculate about why.
I don't have numbers.
Irresponsibly.
I don't have numbers in front of me, but, you know, I do think that those Disney books over at Marvel did not sell fantastically. And certainly mm-hmm. I know that Boom Studios did pretty good with their Disney properties when they had them over there. So I don't know. Maybe it's the willingness of IDW to, you know, as I forget who said a little bit ago, that they do have deals with Marvel and DC to publish their big collections, and they understand how to get those things yep. done right and out the door. So maybe that's part of it as well. It's just interesting. I just keep waiting for some other shoe to drop.
And it may just be a simple question of, you know, share the wealth, get as many people as possible putting out Star Wars properties to maximize our synergistic profits, then take the money and run. Oot, oot, oot.
You got to think that there's some kind of a you own us kind of discount that's there.
I don't know. I mean, well, and this
I'm sure
is
you can't do it, but.
We presume that Marvel and Lucasfilm are both equally part of this Disney conglomerate and that they're working side by side. And that may not be the case. I mean, this may be something where Lucasfilm has, whoever is Lucasfilm now, has the ability to say, look, we're going to do this with IDW because they gave us a better pitch. I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, maybe.
Well, and that's the thing is, like, when you are an outside company, like say Marvel wasn't owned by Disney and they were just, but they had like traditionally been doing these comics. They can say, hey, Marvel, do this for cheaper. And Marvel might bite the bullet and be like, okay, well, we might recoup it on the back end. Now that they're actually part of the company, if they're like, hey, Marvel, we need to do this for cheaper. And they're like, we will, but you, our parent company, will lose money on the deal.
Mm-hmm.
Then they'll be like, oh, wait, never mind. Suddenly, we actually care about your profits.
Yeah.
Let's not do that.
And as for the why didn't they go back to Dark Horse question, I think it's a simple, we don't go back to the well once we've poisoned
the situation. And I think that's why they didn't go with Boom either. because Boom used to have the Disney stuff.
Yeah, they have all the Disney stuff. Darkwing Ducks, the DuckTales, the Donald Duck, all that stuff. So,
but yeah, those bridges may be rebuilt someday, but they're kind of singed at this stage.
Still kind of hurting from that burn. Yeah. All right, listeners, you can head over to majorspoilers.com, check out upcoming Last Jedi news. You can check out photos from Star Wars Celebration. Of course, there's all sorts of Star Wars stuff coming out every single day between now and December. I think we're going to get flooded with stuff. I'd be okay if that were the only, I would be okay if that were the only trailer we got between now and December.
Yeah, I'd be okay too, but it ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
I'd be we're going to have
the trailer of the book of the film of the hat from the film directory of the same name.
Yeah. Mm, yeah. Star Wars. Yay. Let's do some
and
reviews.
Finn's still in a coma. Reviews.
Let us start with, why don't we start with Rodrigo, since you're actually reviewing a comic book this week.
What? Yeah.
You didn't get the memo?
No, because I figured he was going to do something from Dark Horse, but he does not. He's doing something from, who is this? This is Action Labs or who
Action
is this?
Action Lab, Danger Zone.
Oh, that's their risque.
Lana. It is.
They're more
Lana. Lana.
So, yes, Danger Action Zone. Lab, Danger Zone presents AmeriKarate. The story of a American veteran of some war that comes back to the States and has to fight an evil country that he was fighting prior called Neon, that has these karate ninjas that are coming after him. Luckily, he is a karate guy himself. This comic is pretty weird. If you guys ever saw Kung Fury,
yes,
it has a similar vibe. It's not the same. It's not like but it's a similar idea. This like master martial artist who is kind of on this mission against the overwhelming odds, except on this side it's, you know, neon ninjas as opposed to time traveling Nazis. It's interesting. It is an adult book. There's some cursing. There's some nudity. There are characters getting hacked apart on screen. There's a lot of references to a guy having no arms and no legs. Just
How
kind of
that's a different joke.
Yeah, I don't know. I was reading this and I was like, you know, all of these, like, because the guy's always talking about how his brother has no arms and no legs, but he's dead now. And it's like, yeah, and it's really funny. It's like it shouldn't matter, but he keeps referencing it. It's like it doesn't matter. The guy's dead, you know, but it keeps coming up. And it's funny, but also I'm like, are they like really just like going to go through this whole thing, just making jokes about disabled people? It's difficult. It's a sort of thing. This whole book, at least at times, the sort of book where you find yourself chuckling and then thinking, should I have laughed at that?
Right.
The art is really good. It's very stylized. The main character has a gigantic head and kind of big Popeye arms and a long flowing mane. He kind of has a Brock Samson thing going. He gets involved with a CIA agent who is a sexy lady. You actually straight up see her boobies in this because it's a Danger Zone title.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pretty weird show, but it's entertaining. There are some very memorable villains in this, and by the end of the issue, it really looks like the bad guys are going to get one up on the hero. So, you know, it leaves it in a big cliffhanger. Altogether, I'm going to give this 3 slices of meatloaf. It is good. It's doing everything right. It's solid. But, you know, I think a lot of the time with these titles, it's kind of like they have a quota to fill for like gratuitous violence and sex.
Mm-hmm.
Cause it's like, well, we already put the warning on the cover, so we have to go all out for it. It's interesting. It's an interesting read. I think if you guys get a chance, you should at least flip through it.
Yeah, Matthew, didn't you review issue one, or was that someone else?
I don't recall. I did Cougar and Cub.
Okay, maybe that's what I'm thinking.
Number one.
Of.
Could be.
So three slices of meatloaf, Rodrigo, huh?
Yes.
All right, cool. I have a book for you guys this week.
You wrote a book?
No, I didn't write a book, but I read a book.
A
beginner's book. And I'll read you this opening page. The most merciful thing in the world, I believe, is humanity's failure to fully conceive of the cosmical horrors we've yet to reveal and which up until now I've tried to conceal. Sounds a little bit rhymey. Also sounds a little bit like Call of Cthulhu. And you're right on both counts. This is H.P. Lovecraft's The Call of Cthulhu for Beginning Readers by R.J. Ivan Kovic, I believe. It is done in the style of a Dr. Seuss book, complete with illustrated art that looks Seussian and the rhyming scheme and all that stuff. And they tell the entire tale of Cthulhu in about 121 pages. And it is so good, you guys. I mean, yes, it's a children's book. And if you're wanting to introduce your children to the horrors of Lovecraft, because, you know, children can never have too many nightmares when they're 4 years old and trying to read. I really got a kick out of this book, both from its take on what happens if you smash up Cthulhu and Dr. Seuss, as well as just how well they're incorporating things like Rala and all the other things into a rhyming pattern. And it's super neat. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking for something different, definitely go pick it up. It's The Call of Cthulhu for Beginning Readers. It's from Chaosium, the people that do the Call of Cthulhu RPG game.
Games?
Yeah. And I think the art is really well done, and it's definitely worth checking out. It's like $10 if you go and buy it on Amazon. The art is fine. It's right up in there. There may be a few questionable bits, so maybe you might want to look through it before you actually give it to your 6-year-old or 5-year-old or however old your kid starts reading. But spooky, elder god, else out of this world kind of things in this book. And it's done so well. I'm giving it 4.5 slices of meatloaf out of 5. But again, it's Lovecraft and Cthulhu, and some minds may not return as sane as they were when they started reading this book. But that's from Chaosium. Go check it out. Let us do Teen Titans, The Judas Contract, actually. I've been dying. I finally had a chance to watch this last night.
Yeah.
And I am dying to hear your thoughts on this movie.
So I'll preface this by saying that I love the Teen Titans. They're one of my favorite things in all of comic books ever. And I especially love the Judas Contract because I really love Terra.
Right.
So I super like this movie. The movie basically takes the classic Judas Contract story minus the Jericho stuff.
Oh, right.
And presents it to a new audience, albeit with some updated characters in the classic Judas Contract. Your Dick Grayson is your Robin. Here we have Damian Wayne. And because he figures it out before everyone, because we're supposed to believe that he's smarter than everyone, they have to waylay him. So they should have just not put him in the movie, would be my only criticism of it. And Starfire is an adult. Nightwing's an adult. We see them do more adulty things. And Jaime Reyes, like the cast of characters is pretty different, but the implications and the betrayal is all pretty standard. They go further on the Deathstroke relationship than we've ever seen in previous adaptations. The original Teen Titans cartoon from the early aughts, in the second season does a straight up Judas Contract story, and they sort of lay off on the, like, maybe Slade slept with the 16-year-old, but this movie really goes to town on that in an uncomfortable way. I think that where the movie really excels is in highlighting why they made the choice to include some of these newer characters. Jaime Reyes is really wonderful. throughout this movie, and his character stands as a really great counterpoint to Tara. Tara here is really kind of bitchy compared to the way she's maybe portrayed in the comics or the way she has been in other media. They don't bury the lead super hard that she wind up being a bad girl type person. Mm-hmm. And they have Jaime going through some similar struggles, and you get to see him handle them with grace and heroism. So from a writing standpoint, like, it's a nice literary foil, but it's also nice to see Jaime celebrated in this way, because he's a character who really, I think, is just begging to be put on television and to be included in animated adaptations. And it was nice to see it done so well.
Mm-hmm.
I think the fight at the end is really cool, although there are some moments throughout it where you can really see that animated movies that go direct to Blu-ray or direct to digital download just don't have the budget that a Disney or a Pixar level animated movie would. So you can see some of the, sometimes you can see how not moving people in the background are, or where it would seem like the animation stutters for a couple frames. It doesn't really bother me that much. I'm not an animation snob the way some people on this podcast are.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
So it just, I noticed it, but it didn't, it at no point knocked me out of the story. I liked Tara. I thought they did a good job with Tara. And overall, I think it is a very clean contemporary adaptation of the story. I think it fits really well into this world and the continuity that they've been setting up since War. Is that what
I think? I think so, because this movie is a direct follow up to the Teen Titans versus JLA, because it's ultimately a result of that. So that's why Damian and Blue Beetle are in there, and and why those things are going the way they are.
I think this is better than Teen Titans versus JLA personally. And that comes from, I think, the strength of the source material. While I liked movies, like, I really enjoyed Batman Bad Blood. I know that's kind of a divisive movie, and if people didn't like it, then neener, better for me. But I do think that the animated movies in the current continuity excel when they have strong source material behind it. And you don't stick in things that are frivolous like they did with The Killing Joke. But speaking of broad generalizations, and the Juice Contract's one of the greatest, you know, DC Comics ever written, so to see it get its due like this, I think it was great. I'm just not a Damian Wayne fan, so him in this way was unappealing to me. I don't know if you felt different about that, though.
No, I mean, when they first announced this and they showed those first clips of Damian Wayne, I was like, why is he in this movie? There's no way you can tell the Judas Contract. But then when you think that it ties back into, I think Batman Bad Blood, wasn't that when they, or what was the one where they actually went and did the Damian's origin story?
Oh, they did Batman and Son.
Oh, maybe that's what it was, because that Batman, also
Robin, Son of Batman. It was not very good.
Yeah, no, it wasn't very good, but it also is super referenced in this movie. Right.
Yeah. And they do a thing with the actor who the voice actor who plays Damian is like an actual 13-year-old. And the voice actress who plays Raven is like 15 or 16. And I think I understand that you want to do like that Charlie Brown realism, but I don't think it works in this universe, because I think those characters, I think their performances stand out as a lot weaker, especially when you're going to cast Christina Ricci as like 16-year-old Tara. Like, come on.
Yeah. I didn't like the Damian Wayne bit, but I will say this, but by the end of the movie, I was impressed that they were able to tell a Judas Contract story. They haven't told the Judas Contract story, but they were able to tell a Judas Contract story.
And you do get a very strange nod to the Jericho story, but it's largely dropped.
Well, I mean, holy cow. I mean, yeah, literally dropped, because Jericho will appear in this movie. But he gets less screen time than Kevin Smith does at the end of the movie.
Oh, that was the other thing. I thought that was stupid.
So did I.
I was like, it's just, I can't even. It was so dumb.
And for Matthew, who gets very squirmy and uncomfortable when we talk about the Slade-Tara relationship, it's a little weird, because
it's supposed to be weird.
She comes in kind of tarted up. No, I'm not kind of.
Not even
kind of. Really, really tarted up.
Yeah, she did that in the comics too.
Yeah,
and it's just weird.
But it is definitely more on the nose, I think, than in the comics. Just with the modern storytelling sensibility, like,
for those with eagle eyes, there is an appearance by Tracy 13.
Yes, which is cool.
Only because there's a girl whose name is Tracy, spelled the same way, and she constantly wears a t-shirt with the number 13 on it.
Now, is this tied to the continuity of the Killing Joke, or is that a separate thing?
It's all part of the universe. I mean, it's all part of the DC animated universe, so it's part of it.
The Killing Joke was awful.
Yeah, no, the Killing Joke wasn't very good. I did a long piece on that last summer, and it was not very good. And it I even had some problems with the with some of the extreme violence in the last Justice League movie, the Batman verse with Swamp Thing and all that stuff. But I will say
the Justice League Dark movie.
I did have some problems with some of the violent stuff, especially when it came to like the baby being thrown off the top of the church and that kind of stuff. I kind of had a problem with that, but I will say this for the Warner Brothers animated universe that they've created here for their DC characters. They're sticking with their continuity. So if something happened six movies ago, or specifically since the, since Flashpoint, they are following through with that. And it is super solid. And I've got to give them credit for that. Now it may not always work for every film for everybody, but if your only access to the DC characters is through these movies, they're holding their own fairly well, I think.
I do think it succeeds more than it fails.
Yes.
But they have had some pretty heroic failures, and that's worth acknowledging. But I think this is a pretty solid success.
Yeah, I was not disappointed.
And the Blu-ray comes with Tara's two best episodes from the original Teen Titans cartoon, so you can watch those. And a really cool interview with Marv Wolfman and George Perez about like what it was like to be there in the heyday creating one of the, you know, what became one of the most important comics of all time.
Now, some of those things are not available on the digital. Now, digital is available today, or was available yesterday, depending on when you're listening to this. Hello, future people. The Blu-ray array arrives in a couple of weeks, but I wasn't disappointed. I mean, if you're looking for a direct adaptation along the lines of All-Star or Superman, when they did that, that is a more direct adaptation of the source material. This one is not that. I still thought it was fairly good.
I agree.
What you've given it four slices of meatloaf.
I've given it four, but that's because I am a mad Teen Titans fangirl, and they pulled it off a lot better than I thought, but I got to tick it down for a couple of my criticism. That's only the right thing to do.
Damian Wayne.
Yeah, mostly that. How about you? What would you rate it?
I would say, I would hit it in that 3.5-4 range. I found it enjoyable. I thought that the whole Brother Blood stuff I thought was really cool. The Hive agency is something I wish they could explore more in that animated universe, which they haven't. But I thought the action sequences were good. I wish they would animate Garth in more than five animals.
But I think that's a little budgetary restriction that we got going on. But, I mean, agree though.
Considering what it is, I thought it was good. I was really kind of hoping they killed Damian Wayne though. When he gets sucked down into the ground.
Someday, Steven, and you and I will be
they're in love with Damian Wayne. They love Damian Wayne.
Well, they love the fact that Batman has a son. And what kind of conflict does that create with
Superman
his other adopted sons? Yes, the super
sons.
I can understand the appeal of Damian in like an academic way, like because you get the reflection of what Bruce Wayne would have been like without Alfred. And I understand why intellectually that is an interesting idea. I just hate it in execution.
Well, they come straight out. I mean, Dick comes straight out in the movie and tells him what's wrong with Damian. These are, or maybe it's Tara talking to Slade about, here's what's wrong with Damian. He's a horrible person. He doesn't listen. Yeah, he's going on his own all the time. And it's just like, yes. There you go. And then there's a good joke at his expense about kids who don't want to take baths.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I feel like that is, I'm sorry to any young teenage boys who are listening. I feel like that's very apropos of like a 13-year-old boy. I was like, that's accurate.
Not to embarrass my son, my oldest son. When he gets out of the bath, we have to say, do we need to do a sniff test on you? And just because sometimes he does not scrub like he should. So, Matthew, I did not get a chance yet to watch the Doctor Who Season 10, Episode 1 pilot. We've got new characters that are popping up. We've got the final season of Peter Capaldi. Give me a rundown. Give me a breakdown. Was this good? Was this bad? Is this something I should watch or not?
Here's the deal. As an ancient person who has been watching Doctor Who since like 1982, I always tend to make parallels in new Doctors to old Doctors. And the parallels that work for me are things like Matt Smith's 11th Doctor has tons of the second Doctor. And mm-hmm. David Tennant's 10th Doctor is like 50% of the 5th Doctor. And even if you go back to 9, 9 has elements.
The one he's related to?
Yeah, the one that he's related to now.
Yeah.
But 9 even has elements of the anger of 6 and the resentment. But when you say to me, Doctor Who season 10, my brain goes, yeah, that's the season that they did the three Doctors in 1976.
Yeah, John Pertwee.
Or 1973. But here's the important bit. That connection explained to me what I enjoy about Peter Capaldi, and especially Peter Capaldi in this new, that it's actually called The Pilot, which is a not particularly sly nod to the fact that they're kind of doing a quiet retool.
Mm.
Since the show came back in 2005, you've had a whole lot of baggage attached to it. And we've had four freaking doctors in that time in less than 12 years. And so there's a lot of expectations and barnacles and people who can say, I like Doctor Who, but only the 10th Doctor and Rose. And I like Doctor Who, but only the 11th Doctor and Amy. And when you really come down to it, the new series is defined by each Doctor having a companion who kind of really embodies what they're about. So the 11th Doctor had Amy, and the 10th Doctor had Rose, and the 9th Doctor also had Rose, because Rose is a Mary Sue, and Martha got treated terribly because of it. The pilot gives us that first chance for the 12th Doctor to have his defining companion in Bill Potts. And this actually opens, fascinatingly, not with the Doctor, not with the TARDIS, not with space, with Bill walking into an office and sitting down for some sort of interview. If you remember the last two Christmas specials, Nardole, the strange bald man who's also secretly a cyborg.
The guy from Little Britain.
Yeah, he's been hanging out with the Doctor because the Doctor has had, he's had a rough couple 70, 80 years. And we find out in this episode that Bill is a young woman who works at the university who has been sitting in on the Doctor's lectures. And the Doctor has been lecturing at this college for 50 years. So I'm going to take that as saying that the Doctor has been kind of hanging out for 50 years. And when we do see the TARDIS, it's nice. It has a little sign on it that says out of order, which is a nice throwback to the very first episode where the Doctor's TARDIS had an out of order sign when it was sitting in the junkyard. But neither here nor there. There's a lot of that stuff going on here. This is really a lot like the first episode of the new Doctor Who entirely, that first episode, Rose, where we start out from the companion's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
We see her interact with the Doctor. A lot of what we expect from, and I'll be honest with you, Doctor Who can go a little overboard with the melodrama and the big stakes and the high dun dun dun, dun everything I do is crazy and the universe is at stake every 5 seconds. So this is really kind of a refocusing on a more personal take without Clara, who was the miraculous flying Mary Sue of doom. Mm-hmm. The 12th Doctor, he feels a lot more sedate, but also a lot more cautious and maybe even a little, I would say there's still a little bit of mourning going on, because one of the key points in this episode is he looks at his desk, and there are three things on his desk that are important. One is a little can filled with all of his old sonic screwdrivers, which I thought was a nice visual touch.
Awesome.
There's a picture of his wife, his late wife, River, who is dead, and a picture of his granddaughter, Susan, the first Doctor's companion, who may or may not be dead. And this is really the big thing for the Doctor. At one point, he's like, I'm going to send her away. And he sits down and he looks at the picture and says, quiet you. Because it's clear that he feels these ties to the losses in his past. And so I really enjoyed that. I've really always enjoyed Capaldi's Doctor. There's just something about a gruff Scottish man hurling about and yelling at people. And they do a couple of things that are very important to me You know that moment where the new person shows up and there's always the bigger on the inside moment?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they'll mess with it. And the bigger on the inside moment either works, like with Donna, who took it completely in stride, or doesn't work, like with Clara, who inverted it all and showed her how very effing clever she was. This one actually has a really great sequence where the doctor and Bill kind of go through it. And at one point, the doctor looks at Nardole and goes, is it me or is this taking a lot longer than usual for her to figure out? She, at one point, she's like, oh, my God, it's like a great big kitchen. Because
doesn't Nardole also threaten to like remove her from the TARDIS at one point?
He does. And the doctor at one point almost mind wipes her. And she's a fan of science fiction movies. And she's like, I know what a mind wipe looks like. You're not a sci-fi guy, but I know what a mind wipe looks like. And there's just, so there's a real.
Is it a little bit of breaking the fourth wall stuff going on?
A little bit. Not enough to be frustrated. Well, and you know, it's Moffat. So Moffat likes to hang his lampshades. There's a really important bit that I think is setting up more in the season. Something is in a vault in the university, and the doctor has been there because of it. We don't find out what it is. There's a very subtle reveal of the fact that there's not going to be a romance between this companion and the doctor unless he regenerates as a girl, which I really like. And there's an interesting, one of those puzzle box villains that Stephen Moffat likes to put together that isn't really important to the plot at all, but kind of ties it all together anyway, which I think is nice. And at one point, they do travel back in time to a battle between the Daleks and the Movellans, which is, again, another tie that underlines the fact that the 12th Doctor has a lot of John Pertwee's third Doctor in him, combined with everybody's cool stepdad. But at one point, he actually intentionally goes and puts on his velvet coat so that he can be the Doctor and doctor around in doctory ways. I would say, yes, this is definitely worth your time. I don't want to give it all away. The name of the episode, the pilot, actually has a pretty clever dual meaning. The villain is weird and interesting, and there is a visual gimmick to the villain that made me feel really smart because I immediately caught it, and it took everyone else in the house a couple of tries to see what I saw immediately in that first time. When you see the episode, you'll know what it is. But yeah, I would say that this is probably the strongest 12th Doctor story thus far, just all told, because it's not dealing with the baggage of 11. It's not dealing with weird, crazy leftover stuff. It's not dealing with a lot of universe hopping and Clara all over the Clara. I'm not saying I don't like Clara. I'm just saying I freaking hate Clara.
I am.
And it's one of those things where the actress is so charismatic and sweet, and she's a good actress. She's an attractive young woman, and everything she does with the character just makes you want to put one hand on her hair and pet her while you put the other hand on her throat and just tell her to be quiet until she sees the rabbits, because the character of Clara is so frustratingly over the top.
All you have to do is go revisit her first appearance as Oswin.
Yeah.
Where she's wonderful and she should be the best companion ever.
But they tried too hard to make her more interesting than the Doctor. And they started realizing that there's so many barnacles attached to the Doctor that making the companion more interesting than him is really freaking hard. But wow. I think they managed to do it with Bill in a way that isn't, you know, everything about her is super special, magical, and everything is perfect.
Well, and with Amy Pond, they really kind of started down a problematic track of adding that supernatural element to the character, right? Mm-hmm. It's no longer just a girl and the doctor, or a person and the doctor, a human being and the doctor.
Right.
It kind of like spirals out that way. It's like with Rose, we didn't get that until after she had basically stopped being the companion, mm-hmm. and then kind of started having complications and then went back to being normal. Mm-hmm. But Clara just really kind of had way too many things of that sort going, too many weird connections.
She had a hat on a hat on a hat, yep. And yep. For some reason there was a souffle involved. But I would say that I had three questionable issues. I think that parallels between Bill and Rose are going to be pretty much natural because they are both young women. They are both, you know, from kind of a lower middle class background in Britain, and they're both being dragged off to do whatever the doctor does. So I think people are going to spend a lot of time really making that Bill Rose comparison, which bothers me. There was a little joke in the episode where Bill talked about how her job is to make food in the cafeteria. And there was a girl she had a crush on. She kept feeding her French fries until she realized she made her fat. And I'm like,
she doesn't care because she likes French fries.
Well, yeah, it's a cute joke, but I'm just like, ooh, I don't know if I like that. And I think this is my only real complaint about the structure of the episode is you have two tracks. You have here's this monster and here's introducing this real cool character. And we're introducing this real cool character and this monster keeps popping up. And finally, when the monster plot gets resolved, it's kind of like, okay, that's it for the monster. Let's go do other neat stuff. But, you know, that's also Moffat. And if you look at your Sherlock and how much the actual mysteries play into the last couple of seasons, you can see that, you know, it's, I'm going to say yes, Stephen. Go watch this.
I will. I still need to watch
it. You don't have to rush right out in a buying frenzy.
But. Yeah, I haven't seen Doctor since Clara died, so I haven't watched anything, so I'm missing a couple of Christmas specials.
Yeah, that's it. Literally, in a year and a half, you've missed two Christmas specials. Yeah.
You haven't seen the Dr. Mysterio Christmas special?
No.
That's a good one.
Especially since last week.
Husbands of River Song is really good, too. It makes me cry every time.
Especially since last week. The Doctor Who book that came out from Titan Comics is Ghost Stories, and it features the character from Captain Mysterio.
Ghost.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love the Ghost.
So you'll have to check that out. Rodrigo, did you get a chance to watch this Doctor Who?
I haven't, no. I haven't watched Doctor Who since
the Mars episode.
Martha. He left left. He was so in love with Martha, and he cried.
About the second time River Song showed up, Rodrigo was out.
I kind of was out with River Song. River Song to me was, I think, what Clara's to Matthew. Mm-hmm. And it is just kind of this like character that the story and really that the writer gets fixated on and starts. It's kind of like a turntable or a CD player that is out of whack, and like the story just kind of like keeps
cycles,
like it just kind of like cycles around this character and cycles around this character and cycles around this character. So I really got very disenchanted during actually the Matt Smith run because she was so prominent in that.
It was everywhere.
And then I've only really checked back in every once in a while. I remember enjoying that graffiti episode that had
Flatline.
Yep. Mm-hmm. That was a good one. Yeah. I know there's an episode where he's inside of a Dalek. I kind of thought that was interesting. I watched a Mummy one with my mom and she liked it.
Did you see
Mummy
the one?
On the Orient Express.
Yeah.
All right, guys, let's take a moment. Did you guys see the one where the Weeping Angels took over Manhattan?
Yes.
Yes.
Did you see the one where the Statue of Liberty walked into Manhattan?
Yes. That's the same
and
episode.
Stepped up and was nearly going to eat Amy and Rory. And I said to myself, self, that thing is 47 feet tall. How did it walk into Manhattan without being witnessed?
Anybody looking at it, right?
It was nighttime and everyone was asleep.
It's New York.
Nighttime.
It is literally called the city that doesn't sleep.
There's an episode where the moon is an egg and then a monster comes out of it and lays an equally sized egg. Yeah. And at no point does the Earth experience a colossal
questions.
Cataclysm.
Don't ask questions.
No. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. That's Moffat.
You know what questions we should be asking?
What's that?
The major spoilers poll of the week questions.
Week. By the way, four slices of meatloaf for the pilot Doctor Who series 10, number one.
There you go.
So,
if you're going to go get your head right in the DCU, it seems like you might have a hard time with some of the doctors that the DCU has served up over the years. But the question this week comes from one of our listeners. Who would analyze you better, Dr. Harleen Quinzel, Dr. Jonathan Crane, or Dr. Hugo Strange? Matthew, who would analyze you better?
Oh, good God.
Or would they try to analyze you and then go screaming, jumping out a third story window?
So what you're asking me is, do I want to be poisoned, stabbed, or shot?
Well, who would analyze you better? Because, you know, before Harley Quinn went all nutso for the Joker, she was a pretty straightforward doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And one could argue that Hugo Strange, still, you know, a doctor, but he's using it for his own, the information he gets, he's using for his own nefarious ends. Jonathan Crane just wants to scare the crap out of you, so.
Yeah, he's nuts. Well, I would say that I don't want any part of Jonathan Crane because I don't need to have my fears exposed.
Yeah, spiders.
I'm not afraid of spiders. You keep saying that. I'm not afraid of clowns either. You are so wrong on all of these. It's like you don't even know what my soft targets are, Stephen. I am afraid of... Actually, no, I'm not going to tell you that. Jeez, what am I, stupid? No. Hugo Strange frightens me. Hugo Strange turned people into monsters, mm-hmm. and they got all chopped up. And he was part of the classic Detective Comics Monster Laughing Man. Fish story.
Yeah.
So I think what it's really going to come down to is Jonathan Crane is entirely out of it. Do I want to be analyzed by the man who would manipulate me to be crazy, or by the woman who would go crazy with me and also maybe look like Margot Robbie? So, yeah, I had to choose Dr. Quinzel simply because, if nothing else, let's say I need to be analyzed, she might fall in love with me, we might run off and live a life of crime, and eventually she'll be in a movie where I get to show up and, you know, mail dead pigs to CCH Pounder. So really, it's kind of a...
It wasn't CCH Pounder.
Well, who was it?
It's her in the animated series.
Viola Davis.
Well, I was going to say Lynn Thigpen, but I know that she passed away, and I do love her, though. But yeah, I'm going to go with Dr. Quinzel solely because of that scene where Harley Quinn is in the elevator doing the backflip. And I feel like that's really a metaphor for my mental health.
Mm-hmm. Rodrigo, who would you pick? Who would analyze you better, do you think?
So if the question is who would analyze me better, it almost certainly would be Hugo Strange, right? He is a very competent...
True.
Psychologist. Mm-hmm. Whereas on the opposite end of the spectrum, Dr. Quinzel is straight up incompetent. Like she is someone where probably very early on in her career they were like, okay, you have to maintain a professional detachment from patients. She takes one step in and she's like, I'm in love with this one. I'm gonna reinvent myself to be like this weirdo. So very interesting character. Lots of cool things going on. I love the Scarecrow. Like, if you asked me which of these is a better Batman villain, I would go with the Scarecrow. Mm-hmm. But since the question is, who would do a better job of it, I think Hugo Strange would.
Ashley, what about you?
I mean, I think Hugo Strange is unequivocally the best choice from an academic standpoint.
Interesting.
And then also, he makes an appearance in Gotham Academy, and that appeals to me. But the most important thing when you seek therapy is that you like your therapist. And I don't like him or Jonathan Crane, but I like Harleen Quinzel, and she likes ladies. I don't care what anyone said, so I would probably fare the best with her. So I have to go Harley Quinn, obviously.
Okay. Rodrigo, you know, I appreciate your take on Doctor Strange. Or Dr. Hugo Strange, let's make that
Professor
clear.
Professor Strange.
Well, no, he's actually a psychiatrist, so he has to have a DO or an MD degree.
Yes, but Dr. Strange is copyright.
That's why I clarified Dr. Hugo Strange. Mm-hmm. Problem with him is he would really take anything that I told to him in confidence and use it against me to make me do things that I would not want to do.
Oh, yes.
Like blackmail, I mean, whatever, right? I think we all agree. I think across the board, everyone agrees Dr. Jonathan Crane is definitely out of the question.
Oh, yeah, he's nothing. Dr. Crane is a I don't know.
He's a
black banana.
He's a radio talk show host from Seattle. Yeah. That's yeah, there Dr. you go.
He's a triple-decker sauerkraut and mushroom sandwich with arsenic sauce.
From Seattle or from Austin? I don't know. I went with Dr. Harleen Quinzel because... You know, she's legitimately trying to help these patients. She was just drawn into the influence of the Joker, right? I mean, she's not going in trying to, you know, go wackadoo crazy. She's, as a doctor, trying to do her job. She was just very manipulated by the Joker in her origin. So I would say, you know, if she's still a doctor and hasn't gone to the dark side of the DC universe, I think before she met the Joker, I think she'd do a fine job. So that's who I went with as well. Matthew, how have, you know, nobody has listed any comments. No one has this week, which is surprising because usually someone's going to post in and say something. But a lot of people have voted. And how have they voted this week?
Well, overwhelmingly, 53% of the vote going for Dr. Harlene Quinzel. And in this case, it can't be because she has the best looking picture. So only 7% have anything to say to Jonathan Crane, who... Well, wow. I mean,
if,
come
listen,
on.
Listener, if you went out there and voted for Jonathan Crane, please use the comments section and tell us why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we really want to know what you possibly. Well, and it may be the expectation that he'll his ability to see through your phobias means that he'll analyze you and then destroy you with his information. 40% saying Hugo Strange, whose head looks like a gourd in that picture. So, yeah.
Yeah, where is that? What is that from?
Batman the Animated Series.
Is it? Okay.
Except for the Harlene Quinzel, which I think was a model sheet reference, is where I was able to actually pull her in a costume. That is the anime. All of these are the animated series takes, but the only one that I could find where she was in full-on doctor outfit was a model sheet.
You should have used the Margot Robbie.
No, because that wouldn't go with the Jonathan Crane or the Hugo Strange.
Well, then you shouldn't use Batman the Animated
blah,
Series.
Blah, huh? Blah, blah.
That's real easy. You get Hugo Strange as played by old What's-His-Face from Oz, and Jonathan Crane is played by Cillian Murphy. It'll be fine.
Mm-hmm. But
it's different movie franchises, though.
Yeah, come on, dude.
No, that doesn't matter.
Dude.
But listeners, Batman head over to the Animated Series is technically different movie franchises, depending on what season you come in.
Agreed.
Listeners, head over to MajorSpoilers.com, cast your vote in the Major Spoilers poll of the week. And seriously, if you're someone who's voting Jonathan Crane, please use the comment section and let us know why. There has been something we have been dancing around for a couple of years now, and I think it's time to rip off that Band-Aid in one giant pull. We're talking about the Elseworlds series, JLA The Nail. Now, these are imaginary stories. These would be the equivalent of what-if tales over at the
they're
Elseworlds
all
universe.
Imaginary
No, they're
story.
Not. They're all real.
There are no real Batmen.
Yes, there are.
No. Real
so essentially,
Superman.
here's what happens in JLA The Nail. One day, Jonathan and Martha Kent were going to go to town, but there was a nail in the tire of his car, and the spare was flat. And besides, they wanted to get it on. And so instead of going into town and getting the rocket that held the baby Kal-El, it passed them by. And so the world grew up without a Superman. Raised by Jonathan and Martha Kent. And the rest of the JLA is still there. I mean, you've got your Batman.
Green Lantern.
And your Wonder Woman and your Green Lantern and all the rest. Adam,
did you say your
Flash.
Watermelon?
Yes, your watermelons.
I'm not familiar with Watermelon Man.
It was a horrible, horrible movie Justice from League? The 70s. Don't watch it.
Okay.
But what's going on is that there is someone who is trying to get rid of any aliens, get rid of any metahumans because they're not humans. They belong somewhere else. Let's deport them all. Let's eject them into space. And as the mystery unfolds, we find out who the real villain is. Hint, it's not Lex Luthor. And in the process, dun, dun, dun. You get a few nods to some Silver Age comics and Silver Age characters. And like with most Elseworlds books, oh, yeah, there's your Metamorpho, there's your Hawkman, there's your Lois Lanes. Everything else is a little different than what you remember it, but it's all there. And in the end, when the bad guy is finally revealed and Jimmy Olsen's beating the crap out of everybody, they crash into a farmhouse and a big burly boy comes out and he's like, "You killed my ma and pa," and he goes to town.
Dot, dot, dot. I shall beat you like a jackass in a hailstorm.
Turns out Superman, his baby Kal-El, crashed into Earth and was raised by an Amish family. And that is why he never got into violence or fights or went outside of his community, and why the world never had a Superman. But now that they found him and he's discovered his powers and his parents are dead, he can go out and he can become the Superman that the world needs. The end. Until another The Nail.
Right. Which, it suffers from the same problem as The Nail, to be honest.
What did you guys think about The Nail? Matthew, you want to start? Go ahead.
In the year 1975, Marvel Comics came up with a series called What If?
Right.
And What If is important because the title of What If is a question.
Mm-hmm.
What if X happened instead of Y?
Yeah.
The answer is always everyone dies screaming.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is the biggest weakness of both A Nail and Another The Nail. But we'll stick mostly to The Nail.
We'll save Another The Nail for when we hit our Patreon goal at patreon.com/majorspoilers. Our next goal, we are less than $250 a month away from it, where Matthew will not only review Another The Nail, but he will also review Old Man Logan for you.
Yeah.
And ask the question, why do you hate me? But Matthew, please.
In 1998... I think that Stephen and I were in our 20s. Ashley was in...
Is that when this came out? It was 98?
Canadian kindergarten, yeah. Rodrigo was, 12?
I was 8.
You were 8. Rodrigo was 12. And I remember reading this off the stands and thinking, God, this is dark. Why is this dark? Because, you know, by the end of the 90s, everything in comics was dark and blood and Sturm and Drang mm-hmm. and death and... Everybody had their arms ripped off and their faces burned off and they were blown up. And this is a book that is drawn in a beautiful,
oh yeah,
slick Silver Age style by Alan Davis and Mark Farmer. And mm-hmm. it shows us things like the Ragman and the Creeper and Jimmy Olsen, the Giant Turtle Man, and Amazo looking as great as Amazo has ever looked. And the whole plot
Barry Allen
is
looking
death,
as great as Barry Allen death, looked.
Death. Armageddon, death, death, hell, death, and sports. I mean, it's just Trivial Pursuit with Satan. And I feel like there's a real disconnect between the art and the story, which shows Batman forced to watch as the Joker brutally murders Batgirl and Robin, thankfully just off panel.
Not but by much, though.
Yeah, this story really is... It's a what if. What if there was no Superman? And the answer is everyone dies screaming.
I don't know if everyone dies screaming. I mean, there's some horrible things that happen. And there's certainly some weird things that are going on with the world's... the world's perception of superheroes. Because they think that if you're donning a mask, you must be an alien or you must have metahuman powers. And therefore, you must get off our planet. So there's this whole thing that if without Superman... the world would be super xenophobic.
Why is that exact?
Well, I guess because he is the light, the hope. He is the one. He is the Superman, the first of the superheroes. And because he was so kind and wonderful and generous with everything that Superman does, everyone is more willing to accept an alien.
It is something that, I mean, Matthew kind of hinted at it, or really mentioned it, that these books tend to have this, like, what if this happened?
Oh, sure.
It's terrible.
Look at Holy Terror is another one we've reviewed. Look at mm-hmm. Gotham by Gaslight. Look at, you're right. All of them did.
And the reason for that is that if they were ever any better, one, they wouldn't be as dramatic. And two, what are you saying, right? If a world without Superman was better than a world with Superman, then what are you saying?
Why would there be a Superman?
Exactly.
Yeah, I get it. Stupid, but I get it.
Ashley, what do you think of the story? Is this the first time that you've read this?
This is the first time that I've read this since I was an actual child when it came out. I grew up in the 90s, and so the 90s comic aesthetic really appeals to me, and I usually don't have problems with the armor my head type stories that Matthew doesn't really like.
Death.
Russ.
Death. I am the Batman. I can have no friends, no life, only bats and mans.
I came up with like super dick Batman a la Bruce Wayne murderer who punches Nightwing in the face. Like that's how I think Bruce Wayne acts. Mm-hmm. I liked it. I thought it was interesting. It doesn't bother me that Elseworlds are usually, everything is terrible.
Death.
But everyone is still going to interact with each other. I think Red Sun is like one of the greatest Superman stories ever. So I enjoyed this. I don't need the implication of the Kents carnal knowledge of each other because they feel like my comic book parents, and that makes me uncomfortable. But I mean, like, as a whole experience, I really dug it. I
have to tell you about your real parents.
Look, it only had to happen twice. There's only two children.
My mother was a cocktail waitress. I know better, my friend. Wow. What? I'm just
It's a good Justice League book that you don't need to know anything about the Justice League to enjoy.
Yeah, you really don't. And I think it, for what it is.
Are you sure? I will disagree that, or maybe you don't need to know much about the Justice League, but
this is the internet. You can't disagree with
this. This has some hella inside baseball stuff. I mean, the Doom Patrol gets punked out in like two.
Okay,
panels.
Yeah, but. But I know like what the Doom Patrol is, and I still don't know anything about the Doom Patrol.
But Black Canary assembles the same outsiders that Batman would, only not
the New Gods are in this for
like four panels, four pages. I don't know.
You know,
I think
there's a lot of stuff that happens here that is entirely irrelevant to the story and would like is only there to be like, hey, nerds. Remember this character? Here's what their life would be like in the world of Superman Apocalypse.
Book 2, page 47, has a teeny tiny picture of Halakah Ran, the Green Lantern of Sector 2816, who appeared in a four-issue strip in Tales of the Green Lantern when I was 12 years old. All of those lanterns are somebody recognizable.
Yeah.
In that lantern page. I mean, this is the F-sharp Bell appears in this book, ladies and gentlemen. That's messed up.
He's the dimension with he's for the Green Lantern of the dimension with no light or whatever.
From the area with no light, yeah.
And what I'm getting at is that, you know, shout outs like that and especially Easter eggs and things like that, that's fine. But there's like actual space taken up in this book for characters that are essentially irrelevant. You could have written this book without the Doom Patrol, without the New Gods, without all the stuff, just be like, here's a JLA, here's what they do.
Yep.
Really streamlined a lot of things.
I would argue that this is a book about not the JLA, but a book about a world without a Superman. And because of Superman's connection with the New Gods and the things that go on between Superman and the New Gods, it's almost like they did have to include that because it'd be like, well, what would be going on between the New Gods and if Superman wasn't there to intervene?
And that's the important part of that's an important aspect of this book. This book is not what would the world be like without Superman. It's how much would all of these DC characters that you've been reading about be affected without Superman, right? Like the emphasis is different.
Mm-hmm.
It's not how would the world be different without this super cool superhero? It's what is everybody's life? Every single person that you like in the DC universe, what is their life like in this alternate reality?
We actually see a battle between Ra's al Ghul and Amazo.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, this is a story that's ostensibly about Superman and the Justice League. And there's a lot of that going on in here. And I think that the fact that Black Orchid appears visibly several times in this story, first of all, even I don't know what Black Orchid's deal is, guys. Nobody knows what Black Orchid's deal is, but she's in this and she's an important visual sight gag in several points. And again, I'm not saying that that's necessarily bad because this is a book that says, what if the whole DC universe was under this lens of no big red S? And again, I can get frustrated by the death, the shark is dead, Aquaman's probably dead. Batman's freaking out. Also, if you mistake a full-grown woman for Robin, something's very, very wrong with that costume.
Especially that full-grown woman.
Right? Yeah. It's Catwoman.
Yeah, 90s
Catwoman. I don't
know
if you've seen pictures of Catwoman in the 1990s, but she was not built like a 14-year-old boy. That's all I'm saying.
I just find it interesting. I mean, I would say that... a lot of the Elseworlds stories focus on what if Superman stuff, right? What if Superman had landed at the time of Camelot? What if Superman had landed and the religious order had gotten him? I mean, we get Holy Terror. What would have happened if Superman had been adopted by Tesla or,
That's what would happen?
Was that a Batman story?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they all feature Batman, right? All the Elseworlds styles
started as Batman. Yeah. Basically.
But I do find it interesting that
slightly different this time.
I do find it interesting that it's like, what if Superman were, you know, found by someone else? How would his upbringing be different? I do find there's a fascinating aspect to that. But also I find in a majority of them that the Elseworlds titles are frustrating. And this is a book that, while it is interesting, is frustrating.
Okay. Here's the real steel deal. Are you ready for me to throw down some comic historical knowledge in the reason that you pay me way that I sometimes do on this show?
Well, we'll see if it's worth it. Let's go.
Oh, it totally is. This came out in 1998. 5 years earlier, in 1993, the Elseworlds line was revolutionized by a man named James Robinson with a book called The Golden Age, which took the goofy superheroes of the Justice Society and threw in a little bit of everything, the House Un-American Activities Commission, Who Stole Hitler's Brain, the beginning of the Silver Age, the end of the Golden Age in comics. And it changed the Elseworlds from, wouldn't it be cool if Batman was a cowboy, to let's put more realism and darkness and, you know, real world evils in the stories of our guys wearing tights. And I feel like when you read this book, there's still a lot going for it. I mean, visually, even if you hate this story, I dislike it. I don't hate it. But even if you hate this story, it's worth looking at just for, you know, the panels of the Martian Manhunter getting mad and smashing things, or the shot of Hawk Woman saving kids from a burning building, or that shot where Jimmy's laser vision burns off the Amish man's beard and he's like, I'm totally mullet Superman, you guys. Visually, this is just gorgeous, but I think that it's too caught up in that golden age mentality of reality means darkness. Reality means negative consequences and bad things. And every organization is corrupt at its core. And no superhero can be as good as they seem to be. Something bad has to be happening. And Lex Luthor is evil, evil, evil. So obviously he's going to be in control of everything, because only evil guys ever get to be in control. And it's really a distillation.
Have you looked at
the United States? It's really a distillation of a lot of problematic things into one place. And I think that the story does suffer from one real thematic problem. And the expectation is that only Superman is inherently good and kind and pure. All these other schmucks, your Barry Allens and your Hal Jordans and your Arthur Currys and your Princess Diana, the clay lady from Themyscira, they all have feet of, well, more than feet in Wonder Woman's case, of clay. And they wouldn't be good if there weren't Superman there to
Yeah, but that's act not, as a I mean, throttle. The JLA is good here. They're not depicted as bad guys. I mean, they are
depicted as dark. John kills a couple of people, and Wonder Woman is, you know, la 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 la, and Aquaman abandons the surface world because they tick him off. I never liked Hal Jordan anyway, but this is actually a pretty decent Hal Jordan portrayal. I mean,
yeah, he's kind of front and center.
I think you don't have to put this episode on your next invoice, Matthew.
I think the historic aspect of it was, but
we reviewed and we've talked about Elseworlds before, and we've talked about the Golden Age, one of my favorite Elseworlds books, even before Elseworlds was around. I think it's fantastic.
The Golden Age is fantastic, and it is really well done. And I feel like this is less well done.
And really, what the Golden Age, the secret success, the secret to success of the Golden Age, and what everybody has been trying to replicate since then, and you know, maybe Marvel had been doing it separately with What If stuff, is that this, like, Elseworlds titles allow for exploration of this and that, and for to say, oh, I want this character to have a different costume, or I want Selina Kyle to be Robin, or whatever. It allows you those explorations, but more importantly, it allows you to end things, kill characters, to say, and then Lex Luthor flew to the moon and never came back, or to say, and then Lex Luthor was president forever and he's still president because he became a dictator, or whatever. It allows you to end things. And yes, this book is kind of end crazy in a lot of ways. There's a lot of...
Until another The Nail.
Exactly.
Which has more endings.
which is interesting, because this is, you know, one of the things that arguably it has going for it is this idea that finally the things that superheroes do have consequences. And then, of course, they come out with a follow-up to it, which kind of cheapens everything that happens in it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, whether you like it or not.
Here's something that I find fascinating about this. So I was on the morning stream, and it's been so long since I'd read The Nail. I forgot that Superman was adopted by an Amish community. And Scott Johnson goes, and let me guess, Superman was, and I was plugging the show, and he goes, oh, I bet the Superman was adopted by an Amish community. And I kind of played it off, ha, ha, ha. There's not that many Amish in Kansas, which there aren't. But in our ever ongoing quest to try to figure out where Smallville, Kansas is, if you take into account that there's an Amish community somewhere around Smallville, there are five potential places in Kansas where Smallville could be located. The first one is Yoder, Kansas. Now, there's someone that follows us on Twitter, Yoder of Kansas. I don't remember if he says he's from there or not, but Yoder of Kansas is, I believe, the largest grouping of the Amish in Kansas. So that could be near, you know, Smallville, and that's, you know, south central Kansas area. We also have Garnett, Kansas, which is over by the Kansas City, Topeka area. We've got Marysville, which I forget where the heck Marysville is at.
Northeast, I want to say.
Okay. And then we also have Fort Scott, which is south southwest Kansas, kind of where Jason Inman grew up. And so that's another that's another area where Superman could be. That's four. Now, if you also think about what's going on, and this hasn't come out yet, but coming up in a few years, there's going to be a TV show hitting the airwaves that puts Smallville north of Wichita and with apparently eyesight to Kansas City, if that's where Metropolis is. What's that?
Are you talking about the Krypton show?
No, I'm talking about Smallville, which came out in, what, 2000, I want to say.
2001. So, yeah.
There have been a lot of people that have, over the years, tried to claim that Hutchinson, Kansas is Smallville. In fact, they got the mayor or whoever to rename Hutchinson Smallville for a day, and they have the Smallville Comic-Con there. Hutchinson is the second largest place of Amish people, that of communities in Kansas. So we're starting to narrow it down to south central Kansas as maybe the location of Smallville.
Yeah, but nobody understands how comics work.
Nobody understands how Kansas works, that's for sure.
It's a small town of 90,000.
You know,
okay, well, Hutchinson has a population of what, 47,000, 50,000, something like that?
Dude, I don't know. I've never been to Hutchinson. My sister lives there.
I have.
I don't go places where my sisters live. That's crazy, man.
Yeah,
I might meet them.
Matthew's family has divided out the state, and they don't go into each other's territories because, you know, the business. It's the business.
It's I'm the still whole going, family from Old Man Logan.
I'm still going with more eastern Kansas, but if there's one thing we could take away, Amish communities appearing in this book, then Hutchinson may be the location. 41,000 is the current population from the 2013 population count. What's the bottom line for you, Ashley? Is this something worth reading?
Totally worth reading.
Yes. How come?
Because I think that it is a really solid Elseworlds story, and I think it's a really solid Justice League story, which is pretty much the only thing it has to do. There are, as Rodrigo corrected me on, there are some weird deep cuts that are maybe unnecessary. And if you are averted to unhappy things, I don't think you would enjoy it. But I really enjoy a good Elseworlds, and
It does, like I said, at the beginning, it doesn't bother me that the whole world has to go to crap for them to be a good story. So I think it's a fun story. I think it's a good story. I think it's an interesting commentary on the mythos of the DC universe. And I think it looks really good. So I don't know if you, I would say you have to rush out into buying Frenzy, but if you could get your hands on it, it would definitely be worth reading. And it's not that long.
No, it's only 3 issues, prestige format. Mm-hmm. Rodrigo, what are your final thoughts on this?
I think I wanted something more from the Nail. I think I wanted kind of an exploration of what Superman is, and by exploring that vacuum, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not what it is. It's a kind of mystery rock'em sock'em story, and approached that way, it's very enjoyable, especially because it looks great. I would compare it to something that's even crazier, which is Avengers Forever, which is another book that is just pure nonsense in its own universe. And I don't mean that it doesn't make sense, although it kind of doesn't, but like superhero nuts, like everybody's there kind of stuff. That also looks fantastic. So if that's what you want, if you want to see The Flash and you want to see Amazo and you want to see Metamorpho and all the guys whose names end in O that don't get a lot of play, like, come pick this up. If you wanted to see kind of like that world without Superman, don't pick this up, and also don't pick a world without Superman, because that also wasn't a great book.
Matthew, final thoughts from you.
I have to respect a book that name checks Jimmy Olsen 31, where Jimmy, you know, drinks the plastic formula and becomes Elastic Lad. And I have to appreciate the fact that the story really wants to give us realism on realistic terms, to the point where John and Martha Kent stay home and bang all day rather than driving into town and finding a baby in a rocket. Or, you know, the fact that the Joker, given the power to kill, actually does and stops fooling around with Batman, traumatizing Batman to the point of ending his career. But I think that when I pick up a story like this and I say, tell me something about this universe. What am I going to do? When you're looking at that Superman void, I feel like everyone else is way off track, more than you can really expect the premise of this story, which is there's no Superman, DC Universe still exists, go. That I feel like the darkness is overwhelming just based on the fact of a lack of Superman. That said, it's a beautiful book. I mean, it's gorgeous to look at, and it's just full of crap where you can go, oh my God, you know what that is? That's actually Beast Boy in his original costume back when he had a purple face, you guys. That said, it's not particularly compellingly written. And, you know, so if you're okay with a story that's kind of halfway there and art that's phenomenal, then I would say check it out. I would not say run away screaming, you know, even though I've spent the last 45 minutes saying super negative things about the book. It's not a comic book that would, you know, it won't kill you. It won't leave you with paper cuts and a curved spine.
The biggest disappointment for me with Justice League, The Nail, is that Superman shows up literally too late in this book. It's not the shocking reveal that you get from Holy Terror. It's not the shocking reveal that you get the Silver Age, the New Frontier, right? Justice League, The Nail is very pretty, and it does have nods to everything that you would expect in the DC universe in the 1990s. But I find the story kind of frustrating. And at times it feels like just simple layout things could have changed the entire dynamic of how the story was consumed. You can get the entire 3-issue series on Comixology for $9. So for less than $10, you can read this story. It's not going to kill you. It may be frustrating at times, but it is very pretty. And it is an interesting Elseworlds tale. It is an interesting Elseworlds tale. And there are some really good Elseworlds tales out there. This one's good, but it's frustrating. And go check it out. It's not going to change your worldview, and it's not going to make you run away screaming.
But Katana and Black Lightning have seldom looked better.
Right. That wraps it up for this installment of the Major Spoilers Podcast. Thank you so much for being part of Major Spoilers and the Major Spoilers experience. We could certainly use your help to keep this show going. Head over to patreon.com/majorspoilers. Check out all the bonus stuff, the art, the t-shirts, everything else that you get. And sign up today for less than the cost of the nail. You can support us on a monthly basis and get some cool stuff in return. So patreon.com/majorspoilers. We will be back next week because we know that you love comics and we do too. And we will talk with you soon.
Stop talking about comic books or I'll kill you. I don't care if the Hulk could defeat the Man of Steel. I'm gonna rearrange your things if you continue to debate whether Logan's claws could pierce Steve Rogers' shield. I just couldn't care less if they bring back Kraven. Spider-Man's a clone. Stop spending all our cash on back issues of The Flash, or I swear to God you're gonna spend your twilight years alone.
This podcast is copyright 2017 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.